The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I've got Jim joining me, so he's back after being absent on the last EDU show, but he's joining me from his, we haven't come up with an official name of your Ohio location. Wasn't it the Eastern Region? Maybe we did come up with a name and I'm just forgetting it, but in any case, Jim's back in Ohio currently. He's missing very much fall weather out here in Colorado. He probably realizes that because he just left a couple days ago. But
I thought it was getting warm there in Colorado. It's not. It's cooling down still.
No, it's high 70s, low 80s. And they think that it hit 90 a day or two ago. And they are now predicting that's going to be the only 90 for the whole month of September, which for the past 9 or 10 years, we've had 5 to 10 of those days in September. So we have that early cooling off that you and I were talking about a show or two ago.
Yeah, that's my concern for the garden, folks. And Colorado can be weird like that. Yeah. Anybody who's lived out there understands the weather up there. It can be odd. So, yeah, that's... Unfortunately, the garden is doing good, and my tomatoes when I left were there and green, still smallish, but the cherry tomatoes, I'd say, are still a couple of weeks away, and that's because of the big hailstorm that decimated them in June, and we can at any time in Colorado, I'm looking now, yeah, you're in the high 70s, low 80s, any evening now forward can get below 32 easily. And kill all my tomatoes. So we shall see. Hopefully it'll hold up. 70s are fine, Chris. 70s, mm-hmm. It's the nighttime temperature. The nighttime temperature gets below 32, my tomatoes will be toast. And green beans, none of those like it. The lettuce and kale and turnips and kohlrabi, they love it. But my tomatoes will not, and I will be tomatoless. Mm-hmm. And cucumbers. They'll take it on the chin as well if it hits below 32.
Nice. So you're getting settled into your Ohio location? Got a good setup now and furniture?
It's a good thing. It's a good thing we're not recording this on video because it's still got stuff everywhere. You could tell I'm a bachelor. It's like, yeah, I'll unpack when I have a chance. So right now I kind of live out of the boxes that I moved.
I was gonna say, are you sitting on an upside down milk crate?
No, I'm actually on the love seat, but my table now I've upgraded. It is a $20 Walmart TV tray because I haven't got a desk yet, and it's because I want one of those adjustable desks, and they're hard to find used, and I'm trying to resist buying new. But I like those desks that go up so I can stand, but also can lower if I want to sit. But yeah, I'm settling in, getting used to the area, meeting some people, and going from there. The weather here this week is going to be very hot. up near 90 a couple of days over the coming weekend, and just up into the mid 80s, but pleasurable. Even the guy on the news yesterday, the weatherman, was saying the dew points just are not going to be outrageous. And it isn't. It's very, very pleasurable. So it's warm, without a doubt, but not that hot, sticky weather. So nice. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the weather. There's definitely more humidity in the air than you have in the arid West. But I told you before, it's not the humidity, it's the dew point. And the dew points are pleasurable in the 50s. So I'm not bad at all. It's not bad weather. It truly is quite nice.
Nice.
And I was talking to somebody yesterday. His name's Dave, and he's a gardener like I am. And I keep telling him, I says, I want to go check out your garden and see it. And he says, well, he says, this year I grew sweet potatoes for the first time. I was like, sweet potatoes? And he said it was a total accident. He says he was in his house, he was cooking dinner, and there was a sweet potato that had went to seed. So he said, I broke it in half, just went out into my yard, dug a hole in the garden, stuck it in there, and waited to see what would happen. And he said, I harvested them, I guess this week sometime. And he says, they grew into these massive sweet potatoes. And I said, I didn't even know you could grow sweet potatoes in Ohio. So, and he said, I didn't do anything special to it, Jim. I just stuck it in the ground and it grew. So that's what I need, Chris, to live in an area where you can just put things in the ground and they grow. And you don't have to worry about hail and early freezes and drought and clay soil and all the other calamities that I'm faced with back in Colorado.
Yeah, it's not nirvana, though. So come on, let's not. You got more fungus out there because of the moisture and...
You do. You do. You will. I'll have to start dealing with powdery mildew again. Any gardener knows what I'm talking about there, especially with your squashes and pumpkins. They will just get covered in powdery mildew if it's a wet, humid summer. So, no, it's not nirvana. I agree. And that's why I'm doing, for those who don't know, if you're new and you're wondering why I share this a lot with you guys, it's to just keep people, or at least give you food for thought when you vacation somewhere. And then you think, oh, when I retire, I'm going to move there. That might work when I moved to Colorado 26 years ago when I was in my early 30s. To just say, hey, yeah, screw it. I'm going to quit my job. I don't have a job. I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to move to Colorado. And I'm going to make a go of it. You can do that in your 20s and 30s. You're going to think of things a lot different in your 50s and 60s. At least I am. And you don't ever want to move somewhere because you went there on vacation several times and you enjoyed your vacation. You can come to Colorado, and everybody does at some point, and they experience the Rocky Mountains. And they think, oh, my God, this is beautiful. I would live here in a heartbeat. And the weather was so perfect. It didn't rain. It was gorgeous. Try living in an area where it doesn't rain forever, not just for the week or two that you're there. And it's totally different when you move somewhere. So I'm just trying to get people to understand the more pragmatic approach I'm taking now before I retire to some location, only to then end up wanting to move back. So that's why I'm now renting an apartment after spending a couple of years going back and forth from Colorado to Ohio just to see if I would like it tentatively. Now I'm taking that next step. It's like we're engaged now. Earlier we were dating. Now I'm engaged. So I'm engaged to Ohio. And as such, I feel obligated to be here and spend time with my fiance. So that's why I come out, I have the apartment, I'm engaged, I have a commitment, and I want to see how that works. And if after this three-year engagement, I still like it, then yes, maybe I will marry Ohio by buying a house and moving. But I'm just trying to be a little bit more pragmatic. And we see this a lot with our clients, and we caution them when they say to us, oh God, I've always loved Hawaii, I've vacationed there forever, and we're going to move there. Well, have you ever tried renting and just living there a little bit to make sure before you jump from dating to marriage? You should have this little engagement period where you experience it a little bit more. And we talk too that clients of ours in the Carolinas have a name for people who leave the northern atmosphere, if you will, and move to Florida for retirement. And what do they call it, Chris?
Aren't they called halfbacks?
Halfbacks. And it's people who move to Florida thinking, oh, this is beautiful. I vacation there every winter. It's gorgeous. I love it. And then they move there, and then they're dealing with the heat and humidity in the summer, the traffic, which is outrageous when I'm down there, oh, my God, and the hurricanes. And they're thinking, no, 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 can't live there year-round. But they don't want to go back to the north, so they move halfway, hence halfbacks, and they move to the Carolinas. But the point is, if you guys who are thinking of moving, you might want to consider renting for a period of time. There's nothing wrong with renting, and experience it year round, or at least more often than an occasional vacation, to truly make sure you're going to like it. So anyways, that's why we talk a lot about my move to Ohio. I'm just trying to relate to you guys as a retirement planner, things that I'm doing to myself as I prep for the inevitable that will happen with me over the coming years as the firm gets passed on to other generations and I start to segue out. I harbor no illusions. I'm not going to be 75, 80, 85 and as sharp as I am now. And God, I think I'm getting less and less sharp as the days go on. I don't know. Today, Chris, I told you it's been a hell of a day when we started this. So I don't know if I'm losing my mind, Chris, or if my eyesight's getting even worse. But I get out of the shower this morning, and I'm drying off. And, you know, you're in front of the mirror, you're drying off, and you're rubbing yourself with a towel all down. And I grab my deodorant, spray my deodorant on, and I'm thinking, that didn't quite feel right. And I put my glasses on, and it was my hairspray. And I thought, okay, well, I should have noticed the can is significantly bigger than my deodorant can. So why didn't notice that? Am I losing my mind? But clearly, I'm losing my eyesight because I had no idea. I got the best looking underarm hair right now, but it's probably not the most appropriate deodorant. So anyways, as we age, folks, things happen and things change. Okay. Shall we get to questions then?
Absolutely. Anytime.
All right. So we're going to start with Social Security. We have some PSAs. Do you want to PSA it or do you want me to question it first?
We can PSA it. How about that? Just start off with that.
Okay. Let me find the PSAs. Okay, this one came in more so. Remember last week you wanted to hear from other people who we had that listener, that unique case where the Social Security Fairness Act for government employees and nobody else that abolished the weapon GPO is actually going to help a certain subset of people, if you will, collect their Social Security. And that's, I guess, foreign nationals who moved to our country. Do you remember that?
Well, even broader than that, someone who's earned a foreign pension. Because it could be someone from the United States who worked over in England or in Australia or something like that. So it isn't just non-USA folks. It's could be either one, just having earned a foreign pension, which of course would be a pension earned outside of the Social Security system. So they would be working in a job that didn't participate in Social Security in the years that they were working in that other country.
Gotcha. Well, this email came from some Australians. And it just, again, is sharing because you were asking for some other people. And it said, for Australians who took their payout from super annuitization, and I don't know what that means, but I've heard about it used in Australia before. I think that's just what they call their payout. I don't know. From super annuitization as a pension, before or after their own Social Security benefit, WEP absolutely applied in full.
Right.
But it does say, note, GPO never applied to foreign pensions.
Yeah, and that's the part where I was having low blood sugar or something when that came up. Because it is, in fact, the GPO, which affected survivor and spousal benefits. GPO almost never applied when there was a foreign pension based on the treaties. But WEP did. And in my mind, I was stuck on that GPO doesn't apply to these pensions when I was kind of wondering out loud when we were going over that question that had been submitted that was WEP and GPO going to apply anyway? And so I'll chalk this one up as I had a moment of confusion. I should have remembered this at the time. I'm glad they wrote in and reminded me, essentially, because they're absolutely right. WEP itself did apply. GPO did not apply. So half of the Social Security Fairness Act helped them. Social Security Fairness Act obviously did away with both WEP and GPO for everyone. But the foreign pension crowd weren't affected by GPO anyway, so they didn't gain anything there. But they did, in fact, gain benefit by not having WEP applied, which windfall elimination provision applied previously to your own benefit, not a spousal or survivor benefit. I also am guessing that I have this habit, if you will, when something has been done away with. I realized I've reached the point in time when I was in my 20s and 30s, I felt like, and I think things worked in a way that I felt like I had unlimited brain capacity as far as to store stuff. So I didn't have to worry about storing something and losing something else. I've realized as I've aged, and maybe some of you are the same way, that there's limited space in there now. You've filled it up with all this stuff, having lived. And it's sometimes a good idea to get rid of some stuff so you can hold on to other stuff or bring new stuff in. And so I tend to kind of actively almost purge myself of stuff I don't need to remember anymore. And so with the old WEP and GPO rules, I think some of that might have gotten thrown out in my house cleaning of my brain as well. So some combination of that happened in the show where we talked about this, because I should have at the time realized, yes, WEP going away did help these folks with the foreign pensions.
Hey, very good. Well, anyways, they wanted to relay all that to you.
Yeah, and it's one last thing. It's superannuation is the Australian system that essentially is their version of Social Security. Superannuation, not annuitization.
Oh, yeah, you're right. They just spelled that way. See, I just have annuities on my mind. Yeah, okay, superannuation. Yeah. Gotcha.
Which is related to annuitization because it's can take the form of a monthly payout, you know, like Social Security has.
Okay, perfect. Anyways, that was it. So I guess it's not quite as new an issue. Mm-hmm. You kind of knew about it. You just momentarily forgot about it because you kicked it out of your head to make room for other things.
But you're going to have to change your little addendum or your version of the Social Security Fairness Act title. It's you can't say now for government employees and no one else. It could be for government employees and few others or something like that. So, because we want to be accurate on the show.
No, it's still going to be for government employees and nobody else with an asterisk. Okay. There you go.
Okay.
With an asterisk.
Okay.
I don't think there's that many people with foreign pensions that are going to also benefit from this.
There's some. Yeah. In the grand scheme of things.
Well, don't get me going, because the vast majority of American people is still going to get screwed over with a loss of Social Security at the death of the first spouse. It's not that 98% of Americans have worked overseas and have pensions from overseas governments that are going to step in.
Correct.
The vast majority of people, whether they can afford it or not, are going to lose a Social Security benefit. And as we said repeatedly, if you married someone who's similar to you in earnings, it can represent a 50% loss of secure income.
Yep.
And for people with substantial savings, that's not going to be difficult to overcome. You can have a reserve big enough to allow the surviving spouse to buy a private annuity to make up for it. May not be something that you wanted to donate, dedicate the money towards, but you will be able to handle it. I'm concerned about the 50%+ of Americans who didn't save adequately for retirement for one reason or another. Maybe they worked in service industries and never made a lot. Maybe they made some bad monetary decisions. Yes, I'll concede that. But I keep going back to my dad and his now surviving wife, and she suffered a major hit. And the woman does not have a lot of money. She lives in subsidized senior housing. And she suffered a major, major loss of her income when she lost the smaller of the two pensions when my dad died. And their earnings were, I won't say identical, but very close to identical. And their Social Security benefits were very close to each other. So she suffered, for all intent and purposes, a 50% cut in secure income merely because my dad passed away. Yet there can be some government employees who may have six-figure pensions who get to keep the Social Security. And I just don't feel that's fair. Never did, never will. God bless it for taking it. If you're eligible for it, take it. I'm not saying to make some moral stance and not take it. I'm just saying the politicians had their heads up there, you know what, when they simply said, yeah, government employees don't have to worry about this. Everybody else, you're still going to lose the smaller of the two Social Securities. I just think that's patently unfair. Okay, let's get to other questions. Let's get to a real question, not a PSA. Okay. This one is a long one, and it does have to do with a disabled child. And I know you wanted to get away from it, but it's one that I think we can run down a few rabbit holes with, but it's one that also makes for an interesting discussion. But his question is very long, Chris. I'm going to try to jump around. So there might be things in here and you might say, gee, if I only knew this, let me know, because it might be in his email. I just don't want to read the entire email. He's a longtime podcast listener. No state hint, but he lives in one of the six states that have more than one football team. So I just narrowed it down from 1 out of 50 to 1 out of 6 chance. That's the only hint you're getting. So just close your eyes and pick a state.
Texas.
No, you're not five. Just go to the east a little. Just cross the Gulf.
Florida.
There you go. So he's from Florida. All right, says, hi, Jim and Chris. I have a Social Security claiming strategy question for Chris. Oh, wait a minute. I should have read more. He did give a hint. I'm sorry. Much better hint than mine. We live in the state which is the location of America's first national wildlife refuge.
Oh, I know that one. Florida.
Yeah, duh. All right, what's the wildlife refuge, Mr. Smarty Pants?
I don't know. I'm just joking. We already gave it away,
Pelican,
right?
Island. NWR. I'm not sure what the NWR means.
National
Pelican Island.
National Wildlife Refuge is what that stands for. Like, ah. NP is for National Park.
Oh, that's the first National Wildlife Refuge. Perfect. Pelican Island, Florida. Okay, so he begins. I am 64. My wife is 58. We have a 23-year-old disabled adult child. You can categorize us as a typical VG-er. Okay, we have a reasonably well-funded retirement with current assets of approximately $9 million, half of which are in maybe taxable brokerage accounts, 40% in always taxable IRAs, and 10% in never taxable Roths. I also have a small $25,000 a year company pension. We have no debt. I recently retired, and I'm trying to decide on a Social Security claiming strategy. Most conventional wisdom points to me waiting until 70. But I think I may have a situation that tilts with claiming now. And he goes on to explaining, Chris, that according to the Social Security statement, he can claim today at $32,000 or wait to 70 and get $56,000, okay? Mm-hmm. But his thinking is this. Georgette, his wife, has been a stay-at-home mom and a caretaker for a disabled child. A disabled child is currently on SSI and receives $11,000 a year. But as I look at things, if I claim my Social Security now, which would be $32,000, folks and Chris, if I claim my Social Security now, it will open the door for my disabled son to transition from SSI to disabled adult child, and for my wife to claim child in care spousal benefits. That would allow my wife and son to split roughly 80% of my PIA. So about $17,000 each, although my son will lose $11,000 when of his current SSI. So essentially $6,000 for the son, netting out that 11 folks, and $17,000 more for the wife, all totaled in aggregate. When both my wife and I pass, our disabled son can step up to my PIA amount. And there's one added benefit for doing this, Chris. Non-financial benefit, my son can transition from Medicaid to Medicare 24 months after he qualifies for disabled adult child. So he runs a net present value calculation based on all of this new information, what he calls the claim now scenario, Chris, over waiting to 70. And he feels it's greater than more than $100,000 of benefit with his net present value calculation. And he uses software as well as a calculator. And he went to a place, Open Social Security. I think you talked about that in the past. Mm-hmm. Anyways, he wants to know your thoughts. Is there a better way I should be looking at this? Thanks for your help. Your podcast is outstanding, especially Jim and his mastery of the English language. Thank you, listener.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he said that. For people who didn't follow that very carefully or very easily, let me just say that he's contemplating maybe changing what we might consider a kind of a default claiming strategy for Social Security claiming, which for people who are worried about longevity, waiting till 70 is a popular approach to claiming Social Security. And recognizing that if he claims sooner than later, it actually unlocks the door to some auxiliary benefits that are not typical, that are not available to everyone, available to the subset of people like himself that have a disabled adult child living with them, living at home, which the disabled adult child, whether they're living at home or not, could qualify for a child benefit once he claims. And his spouse, because the child's living with them, she's considered a caretaker for that child, and it opens the door to a unreduced spousal benefit for her called a child and care benefit. So having access to kind of these bonus dollars, these extra dollars for claiming sooner than later, it certainly influences the claiming decision, because if we look at this from a perspective of total dollars collected over a lifetime, it kind of changes the math, if you will. But saying that, I would look at it very carefully, because if you are really valuing Social Security as a longevity protector for you and ultimately your son, your disabled adult son will continue to collect child benefits for as long as they are alive, even after you pass away. And I want to correct one thing. When you pass away, your disabled adult child, the child benefits don't increase to 100% of your PIA. They go up to 75% of what you were actually collecting. I don't think there's an exception for disability there. And your spouse gets 100% of what you were collecting, not your PIA. So because once you're gone, so later in life, there's going to be a certain point where both of you are gone, you and your wife. Likely, I don't know the nature of the disability. I don't know if it lessens the life expectancy of your child, because that could also play a part in this decision. If it's unlikely that your child will outlive you because of the disability that they have, then thinking about super longevity, which normally we talk about longevity, how long you're going to live. Super longevity is what I call how long you're going to live and your children who might be collecting your Social Security benefit after you're gone might live. So, you know, the idea that the child likely, you know, in most cases is going to live longer than you do. But if that's not reasonable, then maybe you don't worry so much about that super longevity issue. But if that is, if it's a disability that isn't likely to shorten their life expectancy, they're just going to have this disability for the rest of their lives, then you might be a little bit more sensitive to trying to create the largest benefit they're going to retain for maybe several decades after you're gone, which a calculator like Open Social Security is not going to put value on that. And also I'd be a little careful on NPV analysis. It, again, is going to hinge on you either picking a mortality age, which is a wild guess, right? Or it's going to use some type of interesting present value adjustment based on life expectancy, and not your life expectancy, just generic life expectancy. So I think a lot of those present value or net present value calculations on Social Security become a little dubious for a decision-making tool when you really look at the weaknesses of the variables being used. So I'd be a little careful on that. And that's probably because one of the reasons why I will admit, and I think within the office, we as a group feel the same way, that Social Security, one of its key benefits is longevity protection. And if you value that part, not so much what am I going to get over my life if I live to life expectancy, but rather what benefit is going to be with me for the rest of my life, and I'm going to really appreciate if I live longer than average, if I live longer than my mid-80s, it's going to provide lifelong income protection that is inflation adjusted, you know, unless they completely change how it works. So, it's complicated, I guess, as far as the decision making. There's a few variables that if I were in your shoes, I would make sure to consider. I mentioned a few here, but there's not going to be a clear definitive answer in a lot of these cases when you look at the numbers. Depending on how you slice the numbers and the tool you use to compare scenario A and scenario B, an obvious choice might not pop out. You're probably going to have to decide on in what way do you find Social Security most valuable. If it is I want to statistically increase my statistical odds of collecting the greatest amount before I pass away, before my wife and I pass away. Looking at it as kind of a present value calculation probably is as good as anything. If you're looking at it as a longevity protection device, then I think you should be looking at how can I leave the biggest benefit possible to one of the couple when the first of us dies, and ultimately to our disabled adult child. That, you know, what is that going to look like? And creating the biggest benefit so that your child gets 75% of it, of that biggest benefit you can create, would still lean towards claiming it at 70. Now, one thing that could open up, you didn't mention it, so maybe and maybe it did. Did he mention, does his wife have any kind of decent Social Security benefit?
No, she was a stay-at-home mom who took care of the disabled son.
Doesn't have much for a benefit herself, so it's all going to be hinging upon his work record. And the fact that he said they have quite a bit of assets now, they didn't give us a dollar amount, but those assets, one of the good uses for it could be to fund more of what they're doing right now until he gets to 70. So that, and you can think of that as essentially buying longevity insurance for the spouse and your child ultimately, by allowing you then, through not turning on the Social Security immediately, to then leave behind the largest possible benefit for you and for your spouse, you or your spouse, whoever passes first, and ultimately your disabled adult child. If it, I personally would lean on the longevity benefits if the disability your child has does not tend to shorten life expectancy. If it greatly shortens life expectancy, then I would be a lot more in favor of let's claim as many dollars as possible and create benefits while the child is alive who's not likely to outlive us. I don't know the circumstances for, you know, for you. And even if you told me the specific disability, I'm not in a position to judge. That's going to be a conclusion you'll have to come to yourselves and decide if that's worthy of consideration in your claiming strategy. So I hope that gave you a little to think about. There's not a, I don't think there's a definitive answer. I think it's going to depend on how you value using Social Security the most.
All righty. Perfect. I like that. Let's get into the other. I think there was another PSA or not. I'm trying to see the group here. There's the one PSA I did. This one is more of a question. I could have sworn I had another PSA like. Oh, yeah. Here's the. Well, this one isn't really a PSA. It's asking you for help. And then there's a real question after this.
Okay.
Begins, hi, Jim and the gang. Jim and the gang. Isn't that like Cool and the Gang? Yeah. Jim and the gang. I believe on one of the podcasts over the last 3 months or so, so this could be a while ago, Chris recommended an online calculator for determining the taxable portion of Social Security benefits. I couldn't find this podcast on the search feature and thought the quickest way to get information would be to fire off this quick email.
Yeah, I can help you with that. So the latest tool I've found that I like and I mentioned on that podcast recently is at the website taxsocialsecurity.com. That's all. It's all one word, taxsocialsecurity.com. It's a little tool that a company called Imagisoft out of New Mexico, it's a software company, decided to put up. The reason I like it is it's clean. There's no ads. You don't have to click through a bunch of stuff to get to it. It's just you just go there and there it is. And it seems to be accurate. I've ran a couple numbers through it just to see if it seems to be working correctly. I haven't tested it exhaustively. But it appears to be reliable in what it's in its calculations. So that's the one I was talking about. So just go to taxsocialsecurity.com and you all will see what I'm talking about.
And I will throw in there that Chris receives no compensation. We have no relationship with
this
company.
No, I have no idea who these people are. I just stumbled across it and played around with it as I first was attracted to the look and the cleanliness, right? There's, again, no ads, no trying to sell you anything. It's nothing. It's just this tool. And then so then I started playing with the numbers to see if it would output accurate results, and it seemed to in the little bit of testing that I did. So that's what attracted me to it. I have no idea who they are nor have any connection with them that I know of. Could be a long-lost cousin I don't know about, I guess. There's always, anything's possible, but
okay.
I don't know of any connection.
All right. Let's get to a real Social Security question. Hey, Jim, Chris, and the team. Your show is still my favorite podcast, and the banter is part of why I enjoy your show so much. Well, thank you, listener. Those that don't like the banter can always skip to parts they don't like. Skip the parts they don't like. Okay. I was checking my Social Security statement, and I changed my future salary to a dollar, as you cannot make it zero. You might want to explain what, when you answer this question, what he means by that, Chris, because some people might be, what are you talking about? The estimate for my monthly benefit at my full retirement age is $3,700, which will be in May of next year when I am 66 and 10 months. That's his full retirement age, folks. He was born in 59. My age 70 benefit in 2029 will be 4,600. So 3,700 folks up to 4,600. Do these numbers include cost of living increases? If I begin my Social Security benefits at my full retirement age, will it be 3,700? Or is that the amount that will be seen in January of 2027 with COLA adjustments added? Just curious of how the Social Security website works. Good question, Chris.
Yeah.
Is they showing him in today's dollars or future dollars?
Yeah, I'm happy to clarify.
Pretty much
that.
What he's asking.
Yeah. So first of all, they have improved the tool when you go to the Social Security website for estimating your benefit. What he's talking about is there is a tool on there where you can enter in your future anticipated earnings so it can kind of do the calculations based on those future earnings that you tell it. So that's what he meant by putting in $1. I didn't realize you couldn't put zero. I think that's must be a glitch or something. You should be able to put zero in there. So he's using that tool. All the results of that are going to be in today's dollars. In other words, they're not creating an estimate. Whenever they're telling you the benefit estimates, and this is true of that old paper Social Security statement you would get, even if you get one now, if you go online and you see your future benefit estimates, they're not guessing at future COLAs, cost of living adjustments. So it's in today's dollars. So the $3,700 you mentioned that is his full retirement age benefit next year in 2026, that actually should increase because we're expecting, you know, a 2-point-something% you know, high twos. I haven't seen the latest estimate, but it's going to be coming out here in the next roughly month or so. The cost of living adjustment for 2026, that will increase his 3,700. The 3,700 doesn't have a prediction for what that is. It doesn't, they won't update that tool until the formal announcement has been made. Likewise, the $4,600 at 70 estimate does not include any potential cost of living adjustments between now and 70. So that benefit would increase. So benefits, whether you're claiming them or you're eligible and not claiming, you still get benefit of cost of living adjustments. And the statements and estimates you get from Social Security about benefits and future benefits don't try to guess as to what future cost of living adjustments are. They just give it to you in today's dollars. And so your ultimate benefit will likely be higher than everything you're looking at as cost of living adjustments happen between now and when you claim down the road. So hopefully that clears things up for them.
I think it will. Very well. All righty. Trying to see here the next question we want to get to.
Well, it's turned into a Social Security show so far.
Yeah, and when I was looking through this, I found another one that borders between a Social Security question and a financial planning question. I thought, let's ask that one too. But I want to make sure I get to the new question of the week, so let me see. That would be this one. Yep. Okay. So this one is a new question of the week. Then we'll get to that other one that will bring Social Security back into the mix. Okay. This has got to be, it's not a very clear question. So I'm going to see if I can answer it as best as possible. He begins by saying, I have all sources of the below in my 401k as Fidelity calls them. I have Roth contributions. I have Roth in-plan conversions. I have my pre-tax contributions. I have in-plan company conversions, mm-hmm. in-plan company conversions, and company matches. So he's got a lot in his 401k.
Yeah.
I don't know if he meant his 401k has all of these elements, or his 401k can have all of these elements. But that's what he begins with.
Yeah. So those of you who don't know what Jim's talking about on your 401k statement from certain custodians, in this case, Fidelity, they will break out of your, you know, 500,000 or whatever's in there. They'll break it out as to where those dollars came from. What are the sources of that money? And he listed through some of the options, you know, deferrals, Roth, company contributions, conversions, after tax. So not Roth, but after tax. Those are the types of categories they're going to put you, you know, display for you on that statement.
Correct. Okay. So he was saying, I was thinking that I would be able to convert these to similar account types at the right time. I don't like the word convert. He's not talking about converting to a Roth. Mm-hmm. He's talking about consolidating. I guess he used the wrong C word. He wants to consolidate and simplify. So he wants to know if he can do the following. Move Roth 401k to, okay, I'm going to skip this first one. I apologize, folks. I'm confused on it. I'm going to jump to number 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then we'll go back to number 1. So he wants to know, can his Roth in-plan conversions be moved to his Roth IRA when the time comes? Let's just assume he's either retired or he reaches the age where in-service distributions are allowed or whatever. So moving it is okay. In-plan conversions, can they be moved to a Roth IRA, Chris?
Yes.
Absolutely. His pre-tax dollars in his 401k, money that has never been taxed, can he move it to his traditional IRA?
Yes.
Absolutely. Can his Roth company match? And I'd be surprised if, I mean, it was allowed under Secure, mm-hmm. so he might be one of the few that are actually getting the company match put into the Roth. Not mm-hmm. every 401k allows that. Can Roth company match be moved to my Roth IRA?
Yes.
Can a regular company match in his pre-tax 401k be moved to his traditional IRA?
Yes.
I agree with all of those. I'm confused on the first one. And listener, maybe if you typed it wrong, or maybe Chris can pick up on what you mean. Roth 401k to Roth 401k.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't know
what he's getting at there.
Roth 401, actually he wrote Roth 401k to Roth 401. I would assume he needs a K after that. If you meant Roth 401k to traditional 401k, no, you can't do that. I don't know what you mean by that first one, listener. Unless you meant Roth 401k to Roth IRA.
That,
so if you have your contributions yeah. in your Roth 401k, because right below that is where he says Roth in-plan conversions to Roth IRA.
Yeah, he had to mean Roth 401k that got there through regular contributions
to Roth,
to
Roth
IRA.
IRA,
and that is allowed. Yeah, everything else he's yes. asking about is going to IRA of some kind, so I suspect it was just a typo.
Okay, so if that's what you meant, listener, and it was just a typo, you meant Roth 401k to Roth IRA, absolutely. Whether the money inside your Roth 401k is your company match that got put into the Roth 401k, an in-plan conversion, in other words, you took money from your traditional 401k and converted it to the Roth 401k, or whether it's your own contributions to the Roth 401k. All of that can be moved to your Roth IRA. So no problem there. And if that's what you meant, it was just a mistype, then that is working perfect. Okay. Anything else I should be aware of when converting these to IRAs? And you're really not converting, listener. You're consolidating or transferring. The big things is just make sure it's done right. You've got a lot of moving parts here. Make sure the paperwork is filled in right. I haven't personally seen, but I've read articles or heard anecdotally from colleagues of accounts being moved to the wrong type of account.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Fortunately, that can be rectified easily. You would think it's going to be difficult, but if the financial institution made the error, it's not too bad to fix. The IRS isn't going to hold it against you if traditional money went into a Roth or Roth money went into a traditional, and it's because the financial institution messed it up. So hopefully that won't happen here, but no, I think it's going to be okay. He did write, the Roth in-plan conversions were post-tax. I somehow have the mixed cup of coffee you describe, and I can't unmix it. I thought once they were converted, they would all be treated like a normal Roth account. I'm not quite sure what he means by that. The Roth in-plan conversions were post-tax. Yes, they're post-tax dollars in the sense, listener, when you converted your traditional 401k dollars.
I think he had post-tax, he had after-tax in the traditional, and they let him convert it to Roth without any tax implications, like somebody doing a backdoor type of technique. I think he had after-tax contributions to his traditional 401k in there that he converted with an in-plan conversion to make them officially Roth so that growth would be tax-free rather than, you know, taxable.
Then if it is that way, listener, the way Chris described, you've got nothing to worry about.
Correct.
That's the whole mega backdoor Roth, mm-hmm. if you will. It's where you're going to put money into your 401k after tax. And then immediately or within a reasonable time frame where there's minimal growth attributed to it, you're going to convert it into a Roth. So as Chris said, it'll grow tax-free. You're describing cream and coffee, and you're confusing when you have after-tax dollars mixed with pre-tax dollars. That's the cream in the coffee, if you will. And that's, we run into that issue, not so much in 401ks, although it can happen there. You run into it a lot with traditional IRAs, where you make, for one reason or another, you have a pre-tax IRA, what I call an always taxable account, because the distributions from it will always be subject to taxes. But you mix it with some post-tax or after-tax IRA contributions. Once you do that, even though it is a little amount relative to your IRA, for the most part, people might have a $500,000 IRA and $50,000 or $10,000, even or $5,000 of after-tax dollars. They get in there one way or another, but they get in. Once even $5,000 of after-tax dollars mixes with $500,000 of pre-tax dollars, like that little mini-moo you get at the cafe that serves the bottomless cup of coffee, when you're at one of those cafes and you get the black coffee and you want to put cream in it, some have these little plastic thin cups with an aluminum foil top called mini-moos, and you move that little aluminum foil top over and you pour that little thing into your coffee cup, even though relative to the size of the coffee cup, that cream spreads through that coffee instantly, and it's very difficult to separate. You're confusing that, not necessarily the coffee and the cream. You're confusing the pre-tax IRA being creamed, if you will, by a little bit of after-tax dollars. What you did is not going to cause that cream in the coffee or pro rata mix. You're just getting your P's and Q's confused a little. Would you agree, or do you think I misinterpreted that as well?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe his 401k is telling him that when he takes money, if he leaves it in the 401k and takes a distribution, that they're going to force him, you know, pro rata between the Roth and the traditional. I doubt it, but maybe he read something along those lines and he's thinking it's the same as cream and coffee. And by moving it out to the IRA, he'd have more direct, you know, control over which of the two, Roth or traditional, he takes money out of. But I don't think, I mean, have you run into modern 401ks, especially at a company like Fidelity that's forcing pro rata distributions between traditional and Roth?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Yeah, I don't think so. So I'm not sure where he's getting that he thinks he has cream and coffee issues. I haven't heard anything in his description that leads me down that path.
Okay. I think we answered that one okay. It's a new question of the week, so it made it. It classic example of sometimes you can be a little bit too pithy in an email, and some people can be rather long-winded. You got to kind of be more like me on the podcast. Get to the point. Don't repeat yourself. Don't say the same thing over and over again and be redundant, because that wouldn't be good. And just kind of give us the information we need. All right. I think we answered it adequately. All right. This next one is technically, well, do you want a Social Security-ish planning question or the annuity question of the week?
Let's go to the annuity question of the week.
Okay. This one begins, I do have to say, if this gentleman's first name is truly the first name that appears in his email heading, you got a wicked cool first name. I don't want to say it, but I'm jealous if that is his real first name. Okay, and it references a Seinfeld episode as well. I so want to share it, but I won't because it'll give away this gentleman's first name. But I'm wondering, listener, if you could write to me and just tell me if this is a fake first name based on the Seinfeld episode. If it is, you'll know what Seinfeld episode I mean. And if it comes back, folks, then I'll share more on what I think could be a joke. But if this is truly your first name, I like your first name. Maybe your parents were Seinfeld fans. Okay. Bugs, Cowboy, and the Jays. You guys are the best. Seriously, the best podcast by far for us do-it-yourselfers. Thank you so much for what you do. Well, thank you, listener, for writing those nice words. Mm-hmm. He has a hint for you, Chris. My state is home to one of the most fiercest rivalries in college football, commonly referred to as the Iron Bowl. Bonus points for Chris if he can name both the universities that compete in the Iron Bowl.
Isn't it Michigan? Is it Michigan?
No.
Minnesota?
No.
Ohio?
No. Keep going south, though. You're going in the right direction.
The Iron Bowl. Alabama?
There you go. University of Alabama and Auburn.
Auburn, yeah. I should have known that, probably. I'm embracing college football a little more, although I started embracing it and then this whole portal thing started and I'm not sure I like it that much. I've historically mostly been a pro football fan, so, but I can appreciate a good college game. But it's becoming kind of a pro light now, and I'm not sure I really like that. But anyway, that's a whole other topic.
Well, I will say, on opening season week last week, I think the game of the year was already played. The Buffalo Bills and the Baltimore Ravens.
I know.
Did you see that game?
Yes, I watched that game. That was crazy.
That was the first game. It was like a mid-season or last game of the season game. It was that twisting and turning and close and action plays. I just thoroughly enjoyed that game.
Well, plus it showed, I think it highlighted, then we can go to the question. It highlighted how much further along or kind of more matured a lot of teams are compared to a bunch of other teams. That by the end of the season, there's a bunch of other teams. I'm hoping my team is one of them, the Broncos, that have a lot of promise to end up being pretty good. But clearly, they're not on, at this point, they're not even close to on the same level as a Ravens or Bills or, you know, I see some chinks in the armor for the Chiefs. And, you know, there's others that I've, you know, are looking pretty good, but boy, the Bills and the Ravens look darn good. Both of them. So.
Yeah. If you haven't seen that game and you don't, or even if you know the score, it's an entertaining game to watch.
Sure. Yeah.
I won't tell you who won, but it was a fantastic game. I enjoyed it. Okay. Back to the question. I am using both CDs and multi-year guaranteed annuities to fund my 7-year delay period. Why don't you explain what he means by delay period, Chris?
Okay, so we refer to the delay period as the period post-retirement, so after your income has stopped, but before all of your secure income has turned on. For most people, that means when their Social Security for both spouses has been turned on. It's that period we call the delay period. Reason why we call that period out is it is unique in its funding needs because you don't have all your secure income turned on. You haven't kind of reached that steady state of having a base amount of expenses covered by your secure income for the rest of your life. That's what secure income, you know, is all about, income that goes forever. The period post-delay, called in our house, the post-delay period, or in our office, refers to that steady state situation you're in now where you've got all of your secure income turned on so we can be looking at your other distribution needs, you know, with that in that context, net of your secure income that's coming in. But in his case or her case, the 7-year period from now until that delay is over is likely going to require higher distributions to fund all the things you want to do because the secure income isn't turned on. So it takes a special type of attention for planning. And that's why we call it out and name it the delay period.
Perfect. And what is you, I don't know if you mentioned this, I believe you did. The delay period is unique because it has what?
It has a known end date. We know exactly. Once that's going to, so we're not worried about longevity, right? An unknown length of time. We know when it ends. Once all your Social Security turns on, which I can't think of a reason why, but for most people, if not all people, that should end when you turn 70. Because right now there's no benefit to waiting till after 70 for claiming your Social Security. So we have a nice clean end date, which if we had the end date overall for your situation, in other words, we knew the day you were going to die. I joke with people all the time, not about dying, but I joke with people all the time. If we knew that end date, financial planning or retirement planning becomes easy. Then it becomes pretty much a math problem because we know the dollars can run out exactly on your day of mortality. And we know that date would completely simplify retirement planning. We don't have that, but we do have a date for the end of the delay period.
Okay. So, folks, picture all that. He has a delay period. His delay period is 7 years. He is using bank CDs and multi-year guaranteed annuities to fund this 7-year period. Unique to him, a little different than the way we look at delay period, he is trying to fund this 7-year period with the shortage in his minimum dignity floor, which is the main expenses we cover in the delay period. When you're delaying, as Chris rightly pointed out, when you are delaying the activation of all your secure income, and for most people, that's age 70, because that's how long you can delay Social Security to. I do believe that will be extended out when they revamp Social Security, not for people listening to this show, but people who, like Chris and I, were 18 years old or so, or 20 years old in my case, in 1983, when the Reagan administration made changes to Social Security and pushed our retirement age out to 67, I don't even know if I knew that was happening to me. I think you're going to see in the upcoming changes that will happen at the dawn of the next administration after the Trump administration leaves in a couple of years, 3 years, not really a couple, 3.5 years. But when that administration is out and the new administration is coming in, they're going to have less than a year to, quote unquote, fix Social Security. Perfect for politicians because it'll create this sense of urgency. And they will probably jam a lot of things through under the guise.
Self-created, right?
Yes, self-created because they're waiting forever and they're just kicking the can down the road and going to run out of road
instead
in
of
a little while.
A long contemplative process where things are negotiated and talked about and ideas bounce back and forth and that whole thing that could have been going on for who knows, you know, we've seen this iceberg coming for a long time. No, we're going to wait till the last minute and then frantically scramble around and screw a bunch of stuff up because we'd scrambled around instead of doing it in a more calm and considered fashion. And we'll end up with something that's messy, which will have to be fixed. And that's what I predict is going to happen.
Oh, absolutely. You know. It's all part of the playbook. They're going to let it get to crisis level. Yeah. I forget who it was. It was Rahm Emanuel or someone said, don't let a crisis go to waste. So they create this crisis level on purpose so they can jam a lot of crap down our throats. And we don't have time to talk about this. We just got to do it. Yeah. Anyways, let's not turn it into a Social Security discussion of what's coming. What I'm trying to get him to understand is for most people, the delay period ends around age 70. So it is unique in the sense we have an end date to it. And at our firm, we use it to fund the delay period MDF is what we call it. He called it the delay period. And I think there's a reason we generally call it the delay period or the MDF delay period or delay period to MDF. Because we believe in funding that time frame, in his case, 7 years, by looking at the amount each year of minimum dignity floor they are estimated to need, subtract from it the current secure income they're receiving, could be some pensions that were turned on, annuities that were turned on, some Social Security benefit from one of the spouses. There could be any number of reasons why during the delay period you already have some secure income coming in. Mm-hmm. When we help create a delay period amount, we will first subtract out the secure income that is already being received because we're assuming those dollars will be dedicated, will be taken in and not spent on fun. They'll be dedicated towards covering the minimum dignity floor needs. Then we can look every year for that 7 year period in his example. We can look at the software printout and see, and I'm just making these numbers up, folks. Gee, it looks like in year one, in addition to the secure income, they're going to need an additional $38,000. Year two, $46,000. Year three, $52,000. Maybe it drops in year four because some annuity turns on and it drops down to $40,000. The point is we get these approximate dollar amounts over that 7 year period, then we can add them all together and those dollar amounts are already inflation adjusted. So we're using future dollars coming in, not just today's dollars. And we put all those dollars together and give someone the lump sum of money that they're going to need. And we give them the approximate amount they're going to need each year. And it's very approximate, but we give that to them. We account for fund spending separately in a different position. He is going to account for fund spending here. So he continues. And he says, I am using both CDs and multi-year guaranteed annuities to fund my 7 year delay period, which will include my minimum dignity floor and fun. Now, we don't know much more about this gentleman, except that he has a wicked cool first name or he's a Seinfeld fan. Other than that, I don't know much about him, and I have nothing wrong with him putting fun into this delay period MDF, if you will. But the way we look at delay period MDF, we kind of have a stated dollar amount each year that we think we're going to need. So if we do use CDs or multi-year guaranteed annuities or whatever we might be using to fund that period, we feel a delay period MDF should have a risk capacity of principal protection, or a degree, quote unquote, degree of principal protection. The money that he's going to need in year one should be more principally protected than the money he's going to need in year seven. But year seven should still have a degree of principal protection, maybe a buffered product or something of that effect. When it comes to fun, we don't like to limit people to a stated dollar amount every year, which is what you have to do when you're putting a spending ladder in place like this gentleman is contemplating with CDs and multi-year guaranteed annuities. He has to feel fairly confident, okay, every year I'm going to spend an additional $30,000 on fun. I'm just making that up. He didn't put that in his email. If his approach to retirement funding, and there's no right or wrong answer here, if his approach is, hey, I do know the maximum amount I'm going to spend on fun every single year for this 7-year period. I know I'm going to spend about, just making this up, folks, about $35,000 a year. And I just want to make sure I have that $35,000 every year added to this delayed period MDF shortage so I can have that off to the side. We tend to favor a different approach where we put fun with no stated dollar amount. We might ask clients approximately how much might you need, but we don't limit it. So we tend to cover fun a little bit differently and outside of the delay period MDF. So I really liked this email because it's kind of half dialogue, which is where people share what they're doing, but also an opportunity for me to share a little bit more on how we view this period. Now, this is an annuity question. You might be saying, well, why are you going down this rabbit hole? Just to kind of teach you guys, especially if you're a newer listener, a little bit of the structure and rationale behind how we do things. So we generally don't put the fun number or the fun money in the delay period MDF. Chris, you do this much more than I do directly with clients. Do you find people often are putting or requesting fun be put in the delay period?
Yeah, when I talk to them, because those delay period years are kind of right away, you've either entered or about to enter retirement, they also want to protect their fund spending. And so they almost treat it, as far as reserving money for it, with as much regard as the minimum dignity floor expenses during that period. So I oftentimes see people using the same type of principal protection allocation choices for their fund spending as well. So it kind of gets mixed together and treated as one and the same, where they're looking at it as total spending for the first few years, both MDF and fun. We're going to fund with these resources. And because they're happening so soon, we want full principal protection and liquidity on them.
Well, one reason I favor not covering fun with a stated dollar amount as we do MDF. MDF expenses, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare are fairly static and fairly well known. You can get pretty accurate in your estimation, especially when you're only going 7 years out, how much you're going to be spending on those five very broad categories. And it's not like 1 year people are, geez, I'm really going to buy just premium groceries. I'm going to shop the first year retirement just at Whole Foods. So I'm going to spend more on food the first year and less on the second year when I go back to King Soopers or something like that. For the most part, people have very static, defined. You're 60 plus years old. You've lived more than 2/3 of your life. You kind of know what you're going to eat and what you're going to spend on food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. But fun, especially right at the beginning of retirement, when you're in the go-go phase, a lot of people, this gentleman clearly can, but a lot of people don't know. They're like, God, I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I'm going to do this, that, and the other thing. But gosh, if an opportunity arises, I'm going to go for it. That's the idea. That's what we want people to do. Once you identify the fun number, you can spend it as fast or as slow as you want. but it should be completely fluid, not dogmatic. That's my personal opinion. But for this gentleman, the meat and potatoes of his question is, he says, I plan on using either a 3- and a 5-year MIGA with $200,000 each, or a 3-, 4-, 5-, and 6-year MIGA with $100,000 each. This should cover years 4 through 7 of my delay period. Years 1 through 3, I will cover with CDs. Now, I'm assuming he might mean a 1-year, 2-year, and 3-year CD to keep things simple. He didn't share that with me, but I'm guessing that's what he means. 1-year, 2-years, and 3 years. So again, because he's covering MDF plus fun, I firmly, because we do this for a living, firmly know he's spot on with his MDF needs. Food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare with his 1-year CD, 2-year CD, and 3-year CD. He can get really accurate on what he's going to spend over the next 3 years on MDF. No doubt in my mind. But fun? Maybe he does know. It's just, this is what I do, Jim, and this is what it's going to cost. I'm going to be perfectly happy with it. But there's a lot of other people who are more spastic, kind of like I am on the podcast at times, and they don't know. They might spend $30,000 one month and barely anything the next. Literally, we've seen it. Because to me, fun should be fluid. Think F's, fun, fluid. So that is just the one difference. And he did ask, he says, can you see anything with my plan? Is it a good idea or a bad idea? That's not really his main question. He put that in parentheses. I think we kind of addressed that part in parentheses, listener. So let's get on to his main question. What criteria when selecting an insurer should I use for each MIGA? What is your lowest AM Best rating? And I wouldn't limit yourself to just AM Best, but what is the lowest rating you would recommend for each MIGA? Are there other criteria you recommend I look at? Maybe the Comdex score or an asset liability ratio. Thank you. And he gives his name, but we're going to call him George. So what do we do? How do we do ratings? This is a tough one, folks, because I believe the insurance industry has, what's that saying? Is it not your father's something anymore? No, if you want to say things have changed a lot, this ain't your father's car anymore.
Right, right.
Something of that nature. Well, this isn't your father's insurance industry anymore. Over the past 10 to 12 years, there's been such a marketed change in the insurance industry that greatly concerns me. And it is private equity getting involved in insurance companies at levels that I personally don't care for. I have no faith in private equity. I think the people running private equity are in business for one reason and one reason only, and that's to make ungodly amounts of money in the various ways that they have done it for decades and decades and decades. And now they see low-hanging fruit with insurance companies, and they're taking them over left and right. And I know the ratings agencies tell us, oh, no, these are still fine. This is perfectly fine. The same ratings agencies who swore on their mother's grave that collateralized debt obligations and collateralized mortgage obligations in the early 2000s, we had nothing to worry about. They were A-plus rated. Everything is great. Nothing bad is ever going to happen. But we all know how that ended. So we have private credit, yes, getting involved with insurance companies and rating agencies still giving them A-, A-, A+, A++ ratings. And it's hard even for me. That's why when it comes to, and he's not asking this, but when it comes to single premium immediate annuities, I tend to favor a very, very small number. You can count on one hand the insurance companies that I personally would feel comfortable with for buying a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. But a 1, 2, 3, 4-year MIGA? I would embrace the private equity companies if, and you seem to be, investing less than the state guarantee funds. Most state guarantee funds are $300,000 to $350,000. Some are $250,000. Some, I think New Jersey is one that's either $100,000 or $150,000. So every state has a little bit lower amount than others on how much they guarantee to protect. And I hate to use the word guarantee, even though they're called the state guarantee funds. And I just said the word guarantee because the first thing they tell you if you actually visit your state guarantee funds website is what, Chris?
It's not technically guaranteed.
It's not guaranteed. It's Orwellian doublespeak. I guess we should call that the state guarantee fund that's not guaranteed, similar to the Social Security Fairness Act. That's not fair. But they're not truly guaranteed. The intent, if one insurance company goes under, I think you can feel pretty safe with your state's guarantee amount. But if a handful go under at the same time, they will be greatly challenged on being able to adequately bail out policyholders. So I'm a little bit more forgiving personally if a client is buying a multi-year guaranteed annuity. And what I mean by forgiving is these big storied insurance companies that I would only buy a lifetime stream of guaranteed income from, they don't need and they actually don't compete strongly in the MYGA market. The MYGA market and the best rates you'll find are with predominantly private equity owned insurers. They're looking to get their teeth into some money. So there's a lot of competition, a lot of competition amongst them with interest rates. So you could be a little more forgiving if you feel comfortable and understand that the state guarantees are not truly guaranteed. I think most will be able to handle one or two insurance companies going under. But God, if there was ever a contagion and several, multiple, especially these private equity, very questionably financed insurance companies start going under. And the reason I say questionably financed is most of them are going to be based out of the Bermuda or the Cayman Islands. They use very loose accounting standards compared to US. They quote unquote reinsure a lot of the risk on their books with wholly owned subsidiaries that are also private equity owned and owned by the same mothership. So the thought is when one goes under, they're all going to be suffering. The private equity company itself is not on the hook for any of this because they run it through insurance companies. And it just can get a little bit ugly and a little bit difficult to figure things out. Remember, a state guarantee fund doesn't have much money at all, if anything, in it. They assess the cost onto the other insurance companies in their state if they write or offer policies that are being offered by the companies that are going under. So it's kind of similar to FDIC insurance, if you will. They assess the bank members to additional fees if the FDIC has to bail out a bank. So the state guarantee funds work in a similar fashion. But if you feel comfortable with all that, you can get into the private equity realm. And I guarantee you, listener, with the potential of buying up to four MYGAs, you probably have four, definitely two, probably three, maybe four private equity owned insurers already in the quotes you received. So it's going to be hard for you to avoid private equity owned insurers. But for a risk period that might run 3, 4, 5, or maybe 6 years, and with dollar amounts that should be under your state guarantee limit, it very well could be worth it for you. I can't answer that question. I do know as a firm, I will never put a client in an insurance company rated anything below A minus. Never. And I would never use an A minus or an A rated carrier or a private equity owned carrier for a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. Because maybe they're fine now, just like the ratings agency swore to us in 2005, 2006, 2007. These collateralized mortgage obligations are fine. They are A+. We've done our due diligence. Keep plowing money into them. This is beautiful. And maybe it was in 2005, 6, and 7. How'd that work out in 2008, Chris?
Not so well. We had a couple of bumps in the road.
Yeah, a little oopsie. So watch that movie, The Big Short. There's a great scene where Steve Carell's character, I forget his name, is chatting with someone from the ratings agencies. I almost want to say AM Best, but it might not be. I don't know which rating agency was being represented there. But the woman had these Doc sunglasses on from the ratings agencies. And they're trying to get out. But you gave them A+ ratings. You gave them A+ ratings. And she just finally settled and said, if we didn't give them what they want, they would have went down the street to our competitor. Because they pay to be rated. So if they didn't get the A+ rating they wanted, they would go somewhere else to get the A+ rating. So just be careful with only ratings. And you have to feel comfortable with the risk. There are some B-rated private equity-owned insurers right now that are offering rates far higher than the A- rated companies. I won't touch anything below A-, but that's me. You do what you want and what you feel comfortable with. Just in my opinion, right now, I don't see this blowing up. I don't, not yet. I mean, something can come out of the left field and you don't see it at all. Some geopolitical issue, another war breaking out somewhere, a pandemic, whatever. But the issue with a lot of these private equity companies is they're filling the books of these own subsidiary insurance companies with the very crap that they're creating. And they're filling the books. We talked about Barron's Magazine doing a research study a year or two ago. I forget how long it was. And found one of these companies had $250 million worth of bonds from some company that Barron's couldn't even find. There's just a lot of hokiness going on, in my very humble opinion, that do give me pause or does give me pause. And I just want to tell this listener, I can't tell you what degree of research you should look at. Everything you listed, ratings agencies, take it with a grain of salt. Comdex score, which is a numerical representation of 0 to 100. The higher the number, the better the score. And it just takes, as long as you have more than two companies rating you, Comdex will take some sort of weighted average of their scores and come up with a more numerical representation of what every company rating this carrier collectively is assigning. Easiest way to understand Comdex, the higher the Comdex score and the highest you can get is 100, the quote unquote more financially sound that insurer is perceived to be. But again, we had A+ collateralized mortgage obligations in 2007 that got blown up in 2008, like a balloon gets blown up when a pin hits it. So it is very difficult to do this. I don't want you to overanalyze it or say, I'm going to stay away from annuities. No, that's not what I'm saying. And I'm not saying to avoid private equity-owned insurers, MIGAs, because they do have the best interest rates, hands down. And I would be very careful when buying a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. I'm less careful mostly because I have the end date, which we'll tie this right back in to the delay period MDF. The delay period has an end date, which makes calculating the amount of money you need to reserve very easy. What isn't easy is the post-delay period. The post-delay period is how much money you need to cover your minimum dignity floor until you die. And we don't know that. So that end date can be 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now. And that's what scares me when buying not a MYGA that comes with an end date and I know how long the risk has to last, and I can look at the economy right now, I can look at the geopolitical risks right now, and I feel fairly comfortable. But I wouldn't right now feel comfortable if I'm buying something that might have to last 15, 20, 25, 30 plus years. That's what scares me, is something blowing up in the future, especially when the people buying it now in their 60s will now be in their 80s trying to deal with settlements, claims, loss of income, geopolitical or economic issues that they can't even understand. I don't want them having to deal with all of that. So I use different criteria depending on the annuity and the time frame. All right, I rambled a lot there, Chris. Anything you want to add? It's a good question. It opens up a lot of discussion points, because some people will use this as a reason to say you should never buy an annuity. Stick with the safe withdrawal rate or something like that.
Yeah,
I don't want you to not do it. Go ahead.
I think it's an excellent point on distinguishing between when you're making a lifetime reliance on an insurance company to hold up their promise, having certain standards, versus I'm just going to be in a short-term relationship for 2 or 3 years in a MYGA. I think you can look at it a little bit differently. So I agree with you there. I'd also caution people from making things too complicated in the delay period. Don't try to time it out so that you have funds that become available from a CD or a MYGA one time a year. You say, well, this is going to mature this year, and then I've got another one that matures next year, and so on. Life doesn't quite work that smoothly. Remember, you're making predictions on what you're going to spend those years, and it probably isn't going to work out exactly the way you expected. Things are going to be a little bit more variable than that. So, plus then you're going to be engaging in maybe 6 different annuity contracts if you're using MYGAs rather than maybe a couple. I think over a 7-year period, you might want to slice it up just into 2 or 3 phases and kind of group a few years together. It gives you a little more flexibility in spending and access, kind of simplifies the holdings down to 3 that you might have. Something like that is the other the thing I'd say.
Well, remember, he said either 2 with $200,000 or 4 with $100,000.
Yeah. But I've seen people try to time it out, like,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I need this amount in 3 years, so I'm going to buy a MYGA that's exactly that amount, and that'll fund that year and that year alone. And then I've got another MYGA that matures the next year for that spending. They rely too much on their forecasts and their predictions. It's not going to work exactly like that. So
perfect.
Makes it a little bit easier to implement as well when you're not doing it year by year by year.
Excellent. Do you have time for another question?
No, that's going to have to wrap for today. We're at an hour and a half, so we got to...
Holy moly, really? How time flies when you're having fun.
I know. So,
I didn't think my day would be this fun when I sprayed hairspray under my arms, but it ended so wonderfully fun.
Oh, that's good. Just stay away from open flame. Thanks, everybody, for sending in your questions. And if you want to send in your own questions for the show, just send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line that it's a question for the podcast, and then include a couple words about the topic. That's always handy. We like your state hints. We'll kind of keep doing that if you supply them. And so, Jim, you have a nice weekend in your second home of Ohio. I'm glad the engagement is going well so far. And everyone else, stay safe, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com, that's jim@jimhelps.com, or call 970-530-5300. 800-800-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.